time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hi, everyone. On September 8th, the Outspoken Cyclist will turn 8 years old. As of that date, you're going to have 417 archive podcasts available for download, containing upwards of 1,500 plus interviews with many of cycling's most interesting people, from past world champions, Tour de France winners, and local advocates, to secretaries of transportation and legislators. I've reached into the nooks and crannies of bicycle building with its array of wild and wacky frame builders, painters, designers, and other creatives. We've reviewed dozens of books, spoken with authors, tour leaders, and have covered trade and consumer shows. You've heard from founders of nonprofits, leaders of major corporations, and industry folks in production and manufacturing. I'm especially interested in covering the political and social issues that face our cycling world and work to facilitate the conversation about infrastructure and safety moving in a positive and actionable direction. I received tremendous satisfaction in producing each episode, from searching out story ideas, tracking down interesting guests, and developing the questions I usually ask, to recording, editing, and assembling the finished product. Over these past 8 years, so many of you have contacted me with your encouragement and praise, and it continues to inspire and motivate me to get better at the craft and search out more fascinating stories and talented guests. So here's the thing. As many of you can guess, and some of you know, the Outspoken Cyclist podcast is mostly a labor of love. For several years now, I had a small weekly sponsor, to whom and the support for which I am most grateful. At the beginning of July, that sponsorship ended, and I have since been pondering what might be the best direction to go. In the course of listening to other podcasts, and in many discussions with my best friend, a.k.a. husband, a.k.a. Brian, the solution I finally came to makes perfect sense to me as I look at what is really important, and especially who is important. It's you, my listener. While there are people in our industry I could contact and perhaps find another small sponsor, it's important to me, and I hope to you, to remain independent and free of any possible influences from the outside. So if you like the show and think it adds value to you and your cycling Jones, that craving you have to know more about the sport and all its idiosyncrasies, please consider donating to the Outspoken Cyclist. I've created a special donor link on my blog, OutspokenCyclist.com, that allows you to choose either a set amount or input any other amount with which you feel comfortable. The link is secure, and the payment page will take you to either PayPal or allow you to enter your credit card information. Once again, that link is OutspokenCyclist.com and is at the top of the page in the menu section as well as on the sidebar. I hope you understand that my goal here is to continue to offer the only podcast broadcast that covers virtually all of the many facets of cycling and to do it on a regular basis that you can count on. Whatever your choice, please know that I appreciate your feedback. We'll continue to work hard to bring you the best conversations that I can and hope you continue to listen to the show. Thanks. Thanks for indulging me and welcome to our show for August 25th, 2018. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is The Outspoken Cyclist. I must begin this episode with a short and very heartfelt tribute for the loss of one of the greatest frame builders of our era, Dario Pegoretti. Dario passed away somewhat suddenly this week from an apparent heart attack. There's been a huge outpouring of condolences and tributes to this remarkable man. His artistry and panache will be much missed and long remembered. I interviewed Dario back in 2015, and if you're interested in that conversation, go to OutspokenCyclist.com and type Dario into the search. Adio, my friend. May you rest in peace. Tonight's show brings you, as promised, a fresh conversation with Jan Hein. Jan's work includes his widely read and devoured publication, Bicycle Quarterly, which is celebrating its 15th year. His store, Compass Cycles, offers many classic parts and his line of Compass tires. And his deep and interesting blog, Off the Beaten Path, is one you would probably delve into for days on end. Jan and I discuss a wide variety of topics today, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. We'll also speak with the New England Builder Ball's Eric Weiss about this year's event, which is coming up September 22nd. So without further ado, here's Jan Hein. Hi, Jan. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. It's great to talk with you again.
Hi. It's great to talk to you, too.
Well, the last time we spoke, which was already like last year, it seems like it wasn't that long ago, but I think it was, we talked about tires and some of the new things you're doing. But now I'd like to discuss a topic that came up from one of your emails, and I get lots of your emails, which I really enjoy, about upgrading a bike or purchasing a new one. What kinds of considerations should we have about a new bike? What would make it different or better from the bike we have?
That's a really good question. I think it's easy to get caught up in the buzzwords of disc brakes and 11 speed cassettes and things like that. But when you really think about it, the bike is a simple machine. When you compare it with cars, it's mostly the engines and electronics that have changed in the last, 30, 40, 50 years. And with bikes, the engine is us. So if we want to go faster, we have to train more. It's not like we can just magically do much to the bike. And so I think what has changed mostly is the way we're riding. And I think that's the main reason why a lot of people are thinking of upgrading their bikes, because they want to ride differently than they did in the past.
So now we're riding gravel more, we're riding paths, we're not riding as much on the road, and we're not racing as much. It seems that we're using the bike for other reasons. So what kinds of things would we look at to maybe make our bike more worthy than buying a new one?
Yeah, I think you've really hit the nail on the head. We are not riding on the highways anymore. And I think especially in the U.S., cycling started and people were coming from cars. And so they rode on the highways that they used with cars, even sometimes on the shoulders of freeways. You know, that can be fine if there's no traffic, but it's usually not that much fun. With a wrong bike or with a bike that is designed for that, you know, if you have narrow tires and you pump them to 130 PSI, you'll always seek out the smoothest roads because that's the only place where it's really fun to ride. And all these back roads, they tend to have rougher pavement because there's so little traffic that there's no reason to repave them every few years. And it used to be we took those back roads and we sort of gritted our teeth and we said, we can't wait to get on the highway again. And, you know, gravel roads, well, we did them for novelty, but it wasn't really something where we said, let's go out there because this is great gravel road. And so what's changed, you mentioned it already, is mostly the tires. If you've got bigger tires, wider tires, higher quality tires that absorb more shock, then suddenly it's just as much fun to ride on rough pavement as it is on smooth pavement. And then you discover that the winding road through the hills is much more fun to ride than the straight highway. There's no traffic. There's no noise. You're part of the scenery. Often the trees touch on top of the road, so you get some shade. There's not as much wind. Gravel roads, you often don't see anybody in hours, and it's just really fun.
I want to talk about tires a second because, of course, you have sort of revolutionized this idea of 650B tires. And if we're talking about an existing bike, how would wider tires work? Are there things that we can do with an older bike that now has, say, 28 or 32 millimeter tires to accommodate some of the even wider sizes?
Well, you know, it depends on the bike. Some bikes have pretty good clearances, and there's actually room. Often also in the past, people thought narrow tires were faster, and we've now found out that they're not. But so people, you know, had a sport touring bike that might accept 32s or even 35s, and they put 23s in because they wanted to go fast. So if you have that room around your tire, you just, you know, take a caliper, measure the tire, how wide it is, or, you know, even look on the sidewall, although that's not always accurate. Many tires are labeled one thing and really something else. And then just check all around how much clearance you have. Usually the tight spot is near the bottom bracket behind the cranks where just the frame has to fit in between the cranks on one side and the tire on the other side, and that's usually where it's tightest. Also, of course, check the brake bridges and things like that and see how much room you have. We usually recommend about 3 millimeters of clearance just because rubber is kind of a sloppy material. So if you've got a tire that might measure 32 when it's new, after a few months, the fibers relax a bit and it might be 33 or 33 and a half, and you don't want the tire to rub on the stays every time you get out of the saddle. It's and the paint is gone and it's just, no, you don't want that. You know, obviously some people are pretty adventurous and put smaller wheels like 650B in the 700C frame and they gain extra clearance. But it gets complicated. You need to do something for the brakes. And at that point, I would say you need to think about, you know, what you want to do. If you're a really good mechanic, you already know what you're doing. If you are more a beginner, I would say it's a project that has a lot of potential pitfalls. Do some internet research. There are websites dedicated to that. Otherwise, just get better tires. The difference between a low-quality tire and a really high-quality tire, probably even more than just the width. And you really don't need 48-millimeter tires to go on gravel roads. Sure, the guy with 48-millimeter tires will roll away from you on a fast downhill. But there's also fun in just getting the most out of your bike. My friend Chris Kaufman, runs many years ago, wrote an article about underbiking. Where he said, you know, there's a lot of fun just working with a bike, doing what it can do, you know, getting out of the saddle on the bumps to absorb the shocks and not just let the bike bounce across stuff. And I think it makes you a better cyclist and it can be a lot of fun too. So I wouldn't sweat it if you really like your bike and, you know, can't put the biggest tires on it. We used to ride Forest Pass in 20-millimeter tires way back and it was fun too.
I wanted to ask a question about the durability of tires and how long they should last. And I know, of course, it's one of those questions. It depends on where you ride and it depends on what kind of rider you are. But these tires today, a lot of tubeless tires especially, what kind of mileage do you think you can get out of these tires?
Well, the one big advantage of wider tires is that there's a lot more rubber on the ground, so you spread the wear over a larger surface, so they last a lot longer. When you can expect out of a 23-millimeter tire, maybe maximum 1,000 miles or so. If you've got 42s, you suddenly can at least get 5,000 miles out of them. So even if the tire costs 5 times as much, the price per mile is the same. The same with the flat. The less pressure you have, the harder it is to puncture the tire because it just moves out of the way rather than, you know, being, it's like if you take a balloon, if it's really, really tight, you know, inflated really, really high, you just prick it with your fingernail and it explodes. If the balloon is almost deflated, you can even poke a needle at it and it just deforms around the needle. And the same works with your tires. So the bigger tires at lower pressures always have less risk of flats, which is another big advantage.
I like that analogy of using the pin and the balloon. That's great.
Yeah, it was really surprising to us because at first some people thought that perhaps we'd get more flats because the wider tire sort of sweeps more of the road surface, so we'll hit more debris. And they thought maybe the narrow tire might avoid some debris, but it wasn't the case at all. I mean, now flats are so rare that, you know, when somebody gets a flat on one of our rides, we're like, what happened? Even though we ride high-performance tires that in theory aren't very flat-resistant.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jan Hein. We're talking about riding wider tires and the advantages that you can get, including longevity of the actual tire, which is interesting. What about rims? What happens? You know, we used to talk about pinch flats a lot. We're not talking about that right now. We're talking about a wide tire, 48 millimeters, low pressure, 30, 40 PSI, and yet you're not getting pinch flats. Are you using tubeless tires or are you still using tires?
I usually don't, because tubeless is sort of, it's great if you're really racing at high speeds on really rough terrain because you will bottom out and then you could get a pinch flat. But in everyday use, we just, it's too much hassle to set up because it's always leaking. It's not so easy. You need special tubeless rims, which your older bike probably won't have. If you are rebuilding the wheels with new rims, of course, probably getting some that are tubeless compatible is a great idea because you can use them with inner tubes too. It's not really the panacea that sometimes people make it out. Mountain biking is different because they are always on rough terrain. But even on gravel roads, we use tubes and we don't pinch flat.
Let's move away from tires a second and talk a little bit about some of the other things we could do with an older bike to sort of spruce it up, make it newer, make it more, you know, interesting for the current kind of riding that we're doing.
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing you always want to think about is what you need for your ride. So I wouldn't worry about derailleurs and huge numbers of gears and index shifting. Obviously, new cables will make your old derailleurs shift as new again, which will be a huge difference, and definitely an investment that's worth making. Otherwise, if your gearing is too large, just get some cranks with smaller chain rings. You know, you can even get some old mountain bike cranks or something like that. There's a lot of possibilities. But beyond that, even if you've got only 5, 6, 7, or 8 gears in the back, it's usually enough to do what you want to do.
You have introduced some new 11-speed chainrings and some interesting gearing ratios with them. Right now, I think there are 3 options. They're doubles. They're not triples, thank goodness, because I think triples shift really terrible. But tell us a little bit about your Reneor's cranks and these new chainring sizes and why maybe we're moving away from these enormous outer rings.
So when I started cycling, it was 52, 42 chainrings. And, yeah, 42 is sort of a big ring, and the 52 is a gigantic ring. I think the 42 you can spin at about 45 miles per hour. And if you're going faster than that, you really should have somebody give you free parts because you're a pro and shouldn't have to buy your own. So for the rest of us, the 42 was a good ring, and the 52 was useless. So when you think about it that way, then if you have a double, well, you don't need a triple, first of all, because you've got rid of the big ring. So you make it a double with a 42-26, for example, and suddenly you can go anywhere you want. And, you know, maybe sometime on a steep downhill you can pedal, but realistically coasting is just as fast because if you tuck a little bit, you gain more speed than pedaling can contribute. So the whole idea is that you have one chain ring that is very useful for most of your riding. It's a little bit what also you see with the 1x11 and 1x12 drivetrains that are popular now. So that when you ride on the flats, you're in the middle of the cassette in the back. If you want to go a little bit faster, you just shift one or two cogs smaller. If there's a little bit of a hill or a headwind, you shift a few cogs to the bigger cogs in the back. And that way, you don't need to shift in the front very often, which always breaks your rhythm because it's a big step, and then you need to shift a few in the back to get back to where you want to be. So that's why it's really important to get the front, the main chain ring, the right size. So it's not so much about the gear range only, but also where you want to be. Like, for example, if you have a 53-36, it's now popular. The 53 is always too big, and the 36 is usually too small, so you're always in between. So you're hunting for the right gear and shifting the front, shifting the rear, and it really breaks your rhythm. And so if the ideal bike is a single speed that has the perfect gear that you just need right now. So the closer you can come to a bike where you shift less, the better.
Well, and you tend to still use downtube shifters and what friction shifting? You're not looking at all of the electronics and modern stuff. You're still using what I would consider classic equipment.
Well, I have a bike with a Di2 electronic shifters, and it works great too. But for me, shifting isn't really the main function of the bike. I shift, you know, once in a while, but it's like, you know, moving my hand to the brake lever or moving my hand to the down tube isn't that big of a difference. And for me, the feel of the bike when I'm pedaling is much, much more important than the shifting.
Interesting. Once again, I want to remind you, I'm speaking with Jan Hein, Bike Quarterly, Compass Cycles, and Off the Beaten Path is the blog. If you have never been there, you might want to kind of take a look at this blog. It's got so many topics. You could like spend your whole day there or longer. So let's talk a little bit about some of the new stuff that is out there and what you think about it. For example, disc brakes. I know you review a lot of stuff. What do you think about all this stuff with discs?
You know, disc brakes aren't really, how to say, for gravel riding, I would say they're not really necessary because you've only got so much traction off your tires on the loose surface. So it's like the brakes on gravel are not that important. And on the road, the old brakes were usually fine. I mean, some brakes for big tires were pretty lousy because they have reach around the big tire. And so the disc brakes sort of have made a big inroad just because they're easy to make. They're independent of tire size. And so for a production bike, it's easier to spec it. But if your bike doesn't have disc brakes, I wouldn't worry too much about it if the braking is fine.
Do you think that this idea of disc brakes, and this is opinion only, do you think this idea of disc brakes is just something that the industry needed to move to sell something new?
No, I think it's not quite like that, because there are reasons for it. And when you look at a modern carbon bike, it's not so easy to put the brakes on, because carbon fiber, you can't put easily something like a cantilever post on a carbon fork, because carbon fiber doesn't deal well with localized stresses. So putting everything at the dropout, the disc brake and the wheel, you know, you've already reinforced that area for the wheel. It makes sense on a carbon fork. So there are a lot of things that work together as a system. The bikes, you know, same with the modern big bottom brackets. They work great in carbon frames because they have a lot of material at the bottom bracket anyway. Carbon is very light, but it's also kind of bulky. But if you try to make a steel frame with a modern bottom bracket, for example, then you would have to make it much bigger and it would be much heavier. And so, how to say, it's just that things are different now. It's not that they're necessarily better or worse.
That's an interesting perspective, that things are just different. And you begin to wonder what's going to happen with the tariffs. I think that we're going to see some changes in what gets into the country at prices that people can afford. Do you think it's a high bar to get you into cycling today? Whereas when you and I first started riding, it wasn't so expensive, and you're still riding classic stuff, but you can't even find that in a bike shop today.
No, but I think a good bike was always expensive. I think, how to say, yes, there were some, you know, really cheap bikes, but you can still get really cheap bikes. I think what has happened is just that as we all ride more, our standards have changed, where a bike that might have been a great bike when you were a college student, just now you look at it and say, well, you know. And so I'm not sure that necessarily it's got more expensive, you know, compared to people's wages or things like that. And there's some great bikes out there that don't cost an arm and a leg. So I would say the best bikes always have been expensive and probably always will be. They're made in small numbers. The tolerances have to be really tight. They require very skilled labor. All those things cost money, no matter where you make them.
Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk some more with Jan Hein. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We're back, and if you're just joining us, rewind, because we're having a conversation with Jan Hein from Bicycle Quarterly and Compass Cycles and his wonderful blog, Off the Beaten Path. So the new issue of Bicycle Quarterly is out, brand new issue. It's been 15 years. What is your new issue about right now?
Yeah, well, it was, you know, we tried to celebrate our 15th anniversary with a whole year of sort of really cool articles. So this one has two big ones. The first one is we took one of the best modern carbon gravel bikes to the Copper Canyons in Mexico, which is just an incredible landscape. Even the canyons are deeper than the Grand Canyon, but they're not as steep, so there are roads going up and down them. I mean, they're plenty steep, but at least you can ride it. And we took a bunch of racers down there and just rode for 5 days through the canyons, and it was just a really amazing experience. It's sort of the way we test bikes is we take them on adventures, because we figure most people aren't in the market for a high-end carbon bike, but they want to read a great story. And at the same time, they can discover what the bike can do and what it can't do. And we sort of try to take them to the limit, because only then can you really figure out which bikes are great and which are not. So that was the main story. And then we also researched in Japan, there were the path hunters who started riding in the mountains long before mountain bikes existed and sort of developed their own bikes that in many ways were similar to what the early mountain bikes were from California, and in some ways really different because they went on hiking trails where they had to carry their bikes often. So they had to have really lightweight bikes that were easy to carry. And we dug through their photo archives and so on and found some amazing stories and things. Like there used to be a road going down Mount Fuji because they had a radar station at the top.
Right.
So they hiked all the way to the top and then they rode their bikes down before it became illegal to ride bikes in the national parks in Japan.
It sounds kind of scary. I'm sorry. Although you do some pretty crazy things with your bikes. You take them really, really high up and you ride them really, really far down. You also did an interview or at least reviewed Harry Havnunian. And I haven't seen. Yeah. Tell us about him. I have not ever, you know, done anything with his work.
Yeah, it was actually an article written by a contributor. And he, you know, went to Harry and he interviewed him and he looked through his photos and archives. Harry Havnunian was one of those early guys in the 70s who really put cycling or bike building in the U.S. on the map. He made custom frames. He, you know, had a racing team. So many of his bikes were ridden to national championships. And it was really interesting seeing some of his design philosophies, you know, where he says, well, you should mount the brake on the inside of the rear stays rather than the outside because it has some very small but still interesting advantages. And so there was a lot of neat stuff like that that we discovered, you know, in that article. And it was fun and we had some good photos of his bikes and really enjoyable article.
I know that there are some nuances in older bikes or even in builders today who are using things that we haven't seen in a long time. And that's one of them, mounting the brake on the inside. Yeah, I've seen that. What are some of the other things that Compass is working on?
So we are always trying to, well, first of all, improve our products. We're working on another tire. I can't tell you anything about it yet.
Okay.
But, you know, there's a lot of interesting things still possible because especially the white tires, it's all still relatively new. There aren't many people who are doing high-performance tires that are not for road racing bikes, but actually for riding back roads and gravel and so on. We're also thinking about expanding our rack program to make our racks easier to put on bikes. Basically, we love handlebar bags because we need to carry more things when we're going off the beaten path. There's no gas stations every 10 miles. And when we go to the mountains, sometimes the weather can change. So you need extra clothes, you need a little extra food and so on. And the handlebar bag is a great place to carry that. But you need a rack under the bag. Otherwise, it sways from side to side and messes up your handling and so on. But putting a rack on most bikes isn't so easy. So we're trying to figure out solutions to make elegant and lightweight and stiff and strong front racks that still fit a large variety of bikes.
What about lights? Now that we're getting towards fall and we're going to be riding when it's not quite as light outside, if you put a front rack and a bag on your bike, what are you doing for a headlamp?
Usually it mounts underneath the rack because it's a really protected spot and it gives a nice low beam that shows the road irregularities very well. You know, the racks we make, there's a light mount that you can easily attach. Some come even with a light mount. Of course, with lights, you have the question of generator hubs versus battery-powered lights, and the battery-powered lights are easy and cheap, but they also don't have a very good beam pattern usually, and the best generator-powered lights, which in Germany they have to meet the same standards as car lights, so they're sort of cut off at the top so you don't blind oncoming traffic, and they put the light field on the ground in a way that gives you very even illumination. They're really great, and one thing that useful to think about is if you are upgrading your bike, some of the parts can go on a new bike too. For example, you know, if you get a front wheel with a generator hub, as long as it's the same wheel size as you had before, the wheel will just swap over to your next bike. So there's a lot of stuff like that. And that's also what I, you know, back to upgrading your existing bike. It's one thing to think about which parts you want to upgrade. Usually it's the contact point. Like if your bike's uncomfortable, saddle is obviously the first one. You know, get a really nice saddle, a comfortable saddle. and your bike will be transformed. The handlebars, you know, if they're too low, get a stem that extends further. There are also different handlebars. The old bars often were mostly for racing, so they slope down very quickly, and there isn't really a comfortable position on the tops of the bars. And, you know, we now offer some bars that are more for long-distance riding, and they have more positions. You know, nice handlebar tape, and then there's always the rider, the clothing, the shoes, the pedals. A clipless pedal probably will do more to transform your bike than electronic shifting. And those are all things that will go on your new bike. When you buy a new bike, you will need to get the new saddle anyway, because the saddle on a production bike is really just there so you can test ride the bike. It's not something that's actually intended for you to keep. The same with the pedals. They're usually very cheap plastic pedals, because they figure you're going to put your own on anyway, so you don't want to pay for good pedals. So those are things that easily transfer to your new bike if you ever get one. And so it's not as difficult to invest that money into an old bike versus, you know, converting your bike to electronic shifting or something like that, where you say, well, you know, if I get a new bike, it's got derailleurs, then I have an extra set.
You know, another thing that a lot of people don't like, but I love them, are fenders. And again, we're getting into fall. We're getting leaves and water and that kind of stuff. It keeps your bike clean. It keeps you clean. What kind of fenders are you recommending?
Well, you know, that's another one of those loaded questions, because
okay.
I hate fenders too, and I love them too. And I hate them when they rattle. I hate them when stuff gets caught in them and so on. But that's not the fender's fault. It's usually that the bike isn't designed for fenders. And so the fenders don't fit well. There's no easy attachment. And it's really hard to put fenders on the bike that isn't designed for them. And in that case, often, you know, plastic fenders are your best choice unless you're a really good mechanic. But if you have a bike that is designed for fenders, putting some good aluminum fenders on there, they don't make any noise. They last forever. They weigh almost nothing, you know, compared to the plastic ones, because the plastic ones are so flexible that all the hardware needs to be steel.
Right.
It's heavy. And the aluminum ones, first of all, are very thin, so they're light. And secondly, they're stiff enough that the hardware can be made from aluminum too. And so, you know, a whole set of fenders, even for wide tires, weighs less than a pound.
Well, I like fenders, and I have been caught without them, and I know the consequences. Number one, you have to clean the bike again, but then you have, it's you,
oh, absolutely.
You know, right? Cleaning the bike, that's
absolutely.
Always my favorite.
Absolutely. I mean,
yeah.
You know, and that's the other thing is, if you have a bike that can do all these things, then suddenly you're not limited anymore. I used to not go out when it rained because, you know, my fenders were not very good or some bikes didn't have them. And now my fenders go, you know, so far down that I don't get spray on my feet. The chain stays clean. And it's, you know, riding in the rain, it's like driving a car in the rain. It's not quite as much fun as in the sunshine, but it's completely doable and it's still enjoyable.
It is. It is. What's your favorite bike these days? What are you riding more than anything else? I know you test ride a lot of bikes, but what's your favorite bike?
Well, my Rene Airs is still my favorite because I built most of it myself, and it's, you know, does everything that I wanted to do, and it's just an amazing bike. It sort of takes its inspiration more from a sports car than from a racing bike, where it's got fenders, you can take some things with it, it's got lights. So even though it rides as well and climbs as fast as a racing bike, it isn't limited by good weather. I can go any distance I want, I can ride through the night. It's a really fun bike, and I think it's still my favorite.
Do I remember that you rode PBP on a tandem?
That was years ago, yeah. It was a 1946 tandem. So even in 2003, it was already almost 60 years old. And it was faster than the modern tandem, which, you know, brings back the point that what has changed is the human body, perhaps. That's why the Tour de France is getting faster. It's not that the bikes are really that different, especially the best ones. I mean, it's not fair. Sometimes people say, oh, my new bike is so much better. So, well, you know, you used to have a $300 10-speed, and now you bought a $3,000 racing bike, and you say it's better. You would expect that.
Yeah, one would hope. One would hope. That's
yeah.
True. That's true.
But if you compare the best bike from 1946 and the best bike from today, the difference is remarkably small.
Because it's still a bicycle with two wheels and a chain. I you know, that's always
exactly.
Been, it's not a bike till you put a chain on it. Which brings me to another question that didn't occur to me. What do you think about these carbon fiber Gates drives, the belt drives?
Oh, the belt drives. You know, it's a really interesting idea because you don't have to lubricate your chain. and you don't get black marks when you touch the chain and so on. But on the other hand, there are some limitations. You need to build a special frame because you can't break the belt. So you must break the frame to get the belt on and off if it ever needs replacement. It only comes in certain lengths. So again, you're limited in how you design your bike. It doesn't work with derailleurs, so you need an internally geared hub. I can see it in some limited applications, some city bikes and things, but otherwise, not so much. And realistically, as I was saying earlier, with the good fenders, I don't lubricate my chain often anyway. And most experienced cyclists don't touch the chain with their legs all that often. So I'm not sure that, you know, the occasional black mark on my leg is worth the hassle and expense and special frame design and everything of the belt drive. You know, I mean, I ride my bikes a long time and nobody knows how long these will be available. Well, chains have been around for 130 years?
Probably.
I'm going to be able to get chains for my bike for a long, long time.
Yeah, one would hope so. Yes, indeed. That's true. That is true. I know that we've put some belts on for timing chains for tandem, but we haven't actually used them for the drive side yet. I also wanted to ask about roll-off hubs or internally geared hubs. Have you done any testing on them?
Yeah, and I think, you know, they're really fascinating from a from an engineering perspective, because it's all in there. You don't ever have to clean it. It's maintenance-free. But it does change the feel of the bike because you suddenly have a lot of weight in the back of the wheel. And so Harry Hovnanian was talking about how moving the bike from the outside to the inside of the seat space changes the feel of the bike. Well, I'm not so sure. But when you take a pound and a half and move it to the rear hub, it does change how the bike feels. It changes how it leans in the corners. It changes how you can lift the rear wheel when you jump over bumps and things like that. It just changes how the bike rides. And so if you like the feel of a performance bike, sort of the spirited ride, the light feel that you get with a really great bike, the gear hub is not a good choice. On the other hand, if you're more like for commuting or something like that, we're just, you know, more grinding and plodding along a bit, it's great because you don't ever have to worry about anything. You just, you know, twist the lever and get a new gear.
While that's true, I know that the roll-off, it's not 100% maintenance-free. You have to change the oil in it. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, we ride our test bikes for 200 miles.
Right.
During those intervals, we don't need to change the oil, but yeah.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about technical trials. I know that there were technical trials this year, but they were not the kind that you were going to go to because they were mountain?
I was interested. You know, they were more into adventure bikes. It was just the timing didn't work out for us. And it just, you know, they were in France. We went last year when they were looking at high-performance random air bikes for sort of long-distance riding, the bikes that are dear to my heart.
Yeah.
And I think you featured Peter Weigel, who worked with us on building a bike for that event. And it was really a lot of fun. We wanted to show a steel bike with almost no carbon parts can be super light. And we managed to get the bike down to 20 pounds with racks and fenders and generator hubs and, you know, gears and even a pump. So that was pretty impressive. It was a lot of fun, but it was a huge amount of work. And I don't think Peter wants to build another one. And certainly he didn't want to build a monster cross adventure bike.
Right.
That's just not his style. And so, yeah, that's why we didn't go this year. Although it sounded like a really fun event.
Well, when we went to the Builders Ball last year in Boston, we got to see Peter and see the bike. And it is stunning. If you have not seen the bike, you can go online to your blog. You still have it. And I know you featured it in one of the Bicycle Quarterly issues. And
yeah.
So, yeah, people could go see
it. I mean, just look for Google Peter Weigel, Concours de Machine or something. Even if you sell it, I'm sure.
Right.
It'll come up. Yeah, it was a really remarkable bike. And I've ridden it quite a bit since. I took it across the Southern Alps of Japan on a ride where I took the first train from Tokyo to one side of the mountains. And my goal was to catch the last train on the other side of the mountains. And I managed, but with 3 minutes to spare. And, you know, in Japan, you usually have to disassemble your bike and put it in a bag. My bike stuck out of its bag quite some ways, but the train conductor was very, very kind. And there was nobody on the train anyway, last train of the day on this small branch line. And but it was a very memorable ride. And the bike performed great. It wasn't the bike's fault that that I was behind schedule and, you know, almost didn't make the train and would have had to sleep outside on a bench wrapped in my space blanket.
Which you had with you, of course.
Of course. I mean, you don't go to the high mountains without some preparation, because anything can happen, you know. Even if it's just a landslide, you can't get through.
Right, exactly. Are you considering PBP for 2019? Are you going to be riding or have a bike in there or anything?
Not sure.
Oh.
It's a long ways out, but it's a really fun event. I mean, PBP, 1,200 kilometers in France. It's sort of the oldest, really long distance race. Predated the Tour de France, and now it's more for amateurs and randomers. And it's a really fun event. So if I can, I'll go.
Yeah, I think it's a cool event, you know, and I like to see the randonneuring bikes. I really like those bikes.
Yeah, although, you know, people ride all kinds of bikes there. I think randonneuring, because it's such a small sport, there isn't an established bike form. You know, when you look at mountain biking, everybody knows what a downhill mountain bike looks like, or a cross-country mountain bike, a road racing bike, a track bike. All those things are pretty well established. But when you go to randonneuring, anything goes. It's really fun, you know, it's really fun. I mean, of course, we have strong ideas about what works best, but realistically, you can ride almost anything, and it's sort of a wide open event where you can try to just ride it at your own pace. You can try to, you know, beat your best time. There's many different ways of approaching it, and it's a really fun event.
Well, I think as long as you get in under, what, 90 hours, you can do it, right? Isn't it 90 hours?
Yeah, you get the medal.
Yeah.
90, yes. Yeah.
So, go ahead.
No.
Okay. I was going to ask you about some of the books that are on your website. They're kind of, it's an interesting array of books, and a lot of them are about, well, there's posters too. You have some books that I know, and I've seen them on our shelves at home. They are books you are offering, that you actually have these available for people?
Yeah, I mean, some of them we wrote, or I wrote some of them, like The Golden Age of Hand-Held Bicycles was sort of the first one, and it talked about these French bikes from the middle of the 20th century, when cycling in Paris especially was really, like, there was a big bike boom just after the war, because people couldn't afford cars. The bike was a great way to get out of the city. They made some amazing bikes, and the book has become a bestseller. It's now the publisher made it one of their classics, because it's something that they want to keep in the program forever. So we were quite surprised by that. We wrote the story of René Ayres, the builder who, you know, whose daughter I befriended. He was probably the best of all these builders, and we, you know, took over the company basically since then, because there were no Ayres. And René Ayres' daughter said, how about, you know, are you interested? And that's sort of how Compass came about. What else do we have? We have one book about racing bikes.
You have the competition
bicycle.
Yeah,
well, we looked at the history of racing bikes, more the technical history, how bikes evolved. And it's a really fascinating story where, you know, the races became longer and the bikes became better and so many different things, you know. Shifter derailleurs appeared. There were all these dead alleys of crazy frame designs. There was a bike with a lefty fork in 1906 or something that didn't really catch on. And it was a fascinating story. And we ended it with Tony Roming as our record bike, because it was sort of the last handmade steel bike that really was used for the top level of international competition.
And then you have one that's in French.
That's just the same book in French translated. Basically, the Golden Age was translated into four languages.
Okay.
And the competition bicycle into three, and the René Ayres book only into French.
Yeah.
But yeah, they sold well all over the world. It's remarkable.
Do you think there'll ever be another René Ayres?
Nobody knows. I mean,
well, of course not.
He was a pretty amazing guy, and but there's some pretty inventive people nowadays too, and there's some pretty great bikes. I think, you know, you can find really, really great bikes more than ever today, no matter what you want. You know, there are awesome carbon fiber bikes. Like the bike that we took to Mexico was, you know, a racing bike with 48-millimeter tires that rides like a racing bike, climbs like a racing bike, and yet you can go on these gravel roads that are incredibly bumpy and rough and still have a lot of fun.
Was that a Calfee?
No, that was a 3T.
Okay.
But, you know, Calfee can build one too. He makes great bikes. We tested some of his. It's just remarkable the choices that are out there now.
So little time, so many bikes, right?
Yeah. And, you know, to some degree, we talked earlier about upgrading your bike. I think it's really great to do that. But sometimes you might also think, well, you know, if I really fall in love with this bike and it can do things that my current bike can't do, sometimes it's also not a crime to just get a new one.
That is true.
as much as we love to sell you the parts, you know, as much as I'd love to sell you the parts for upgrading your old bike. But there are some pretty awesome bikes out there.
Well, there's always Compass tires. Come on now. we can put those on.
That's
a lot of
true.
Things.
We took the tires off the test bike because they were a little bit on the heavy side, and we thought this bike would be so much more fun with really high performance tires, and everybody who rode it agreed, of course.
Well, you know, you try it all.
Yeah. No, and I think, you know, as a magazine editor, we need to keep an open mind. Like, you know, we test the bike with a roll-up hub, and we don't think, this isn't going to work. We just ride it and see what happens. And, well, it feels different, you know. So we tell the reader it feels different, and then the reader can decide it's for me or it's not for me. We don't, you know, crown the bike of the year or something like that. We just give people the information they need to make a decision, because everybody has different priorities and everybody rides a different way, and so they're different bikes for different people.
It's a really good point. It's a really good point. You know, when a manufacturer, I mean, it used to be, I would say, if at some time in the 1980s, for example, if we had taken all the steel pikes and painted them black and put all Suntour equipment on them, you really couldn't tell one bike from another. But there are some subtle differences, and there are some new things coming out that I think are innovative enough that you really could tell the difference just by going out and riding them.
Yeah, I think the biggest question for people who want to buy a new bike is how much has the technology settled already? Like, you know, I have a bike with disc brakes, and the disc brakes, well, they're kind of troublesome to set up. They're mechanicals, not hydraulics. So I wanted to convert to hydraulics, but the bike has Campy. Now, Campy came out with new disc brakes. Well, great. Oh, but Campy only has direct mount brakes, and my bike, since it's 2 years old, has post mount.
Right.
I have an obsolete bike that's 2 years old, basically, and it's just, you know, that kind of stuff is a little bit annoying. But I think the technology is settling, and definitely the wider tires are here to stay, because there's absolutely no need anymore to ride narrow tires, except for aesthetic reasons. I mean, if you're really in love with the look of a 1980s racing bike, by all means, you know, ride it. There's nothing wrong with riding narrow tires. But, you know, if you think it's going to make you faster, we have to disappoint you.
Right. Because we've proved that it won't. You have proof.
Basically, yes.
You're right.
We've done a lot of testing on real roads with real riders on board. And, yeah, right. There's no speed difference based on the width of the tires. So, well, we talked about that last time. Not necessary to go through.
No, that isn't. It's just so interesting that we still have people who say to us, oh, no, only 23-millimeter tires. And we're like, okay. You can only tell people so often, and they have to find out for themselves. So that's the way it goes.
Yeah, you know, if they really love 23-millimeter tires, why not? You know, it's just like, if you really like the way, you know, a mechanical shifting system works, you won't like the DI2 because you don't just want to push a button. Perhaps you want to feel how the gears engage. And so a 23-millimeter tire feels completely different.
Right.
And if you like that feel, you know, if you like the slight buzziness as you ride over really smooth roads, why not? You know, if you live in a place where the roads are smooth, especially, 23-millimeter tires aren't that bad. You know, it's not for me anymore, but I can totally see the appeal. It's not, you know, there's no right or wrong, because we're all right for fun. And, you know, if we're racing, then perhaps we need at least as fast a bike as the next guy.
Right.
So that we don't have a handicap. But if you're just riding for fun, just ride whatever you like, you know. I mean, there's some people who ride unicycles, and nobody would claim that they're the fastest.
Right, that's true. I actually saw a guy the other day on my way to my yoga studio riding a unicycle and juggling three balls in the air. And I thought, oh, I wish I could stop and take a picture of this guy. It was so funny. So funny.
I wish I could do that. You
Me
know,
too.
That would be great. And I'm very envious that I can juggle three balls while riding a unicycle. And so, you know, why would anybody say, hey, that guy, he's stupid because juggling makes him slower? Well, that's not the point.
Makes him slower. Makes him so much more interesting. He was fascinating.
Yeah. So, you know, I think what you mentioned in the introduction about we're not racing anymore, I think that's really important to think about. It's not, you know, it's often people confuse it. They say, oh, performance is bad. But performance is part of the fun of cycling. You know, a bike that glides along effortlessly, a bike that climbs well, a bike that descends well is a lot of fun. And it's not about racing against the next guy or beating them or something. It's more just about enjoying your body becoming one with the bike and sort of that acceleration that makes cycling cycling, at least for me. You know, otherwise, I could be walking if I'm just, you know, trying to get somewhere, and the speed doesn't matter. But it's not about trying to beat the next guy. So, you know, if I'm having a lot of fun on my bike, whether I'm half a second faster or slower doesn't really matter that much.
I agree. So can I ask you, before we hang up, my three favorite questions?
Go ahead.
What's your favorite food?
Oh, gosh. That's the most difficult question. I don't think I have a favorite food because I like most foods. And, you know, being married to a Japanese, Japanese food is very different. And I really enjoy that. But I also like French food. And it's like, you know, do you prefer dessert or the main course or soup? It's like they can't live without each other.
Yeah.
So I like how's that?
Wouldn't I know that you would come up with an answer like that? I think it's great. So what kind of music do you like?
Oh, it's the same thing, basically, where, again, you know, different moods, different styles, different things. Maybe I'm not really into heavy metal, but otherwise there's, you know, there's so much emotion that these artists bring into their music that when you feel that, it's impossible not to be touched. And it doesn't matter what their style is or, you know, if it's jazz or French chansons or anything, or even Buddhist monks, you know, just beating a drum and you know, having a very monotonous song. All those really move me. And so it's impossible to say I prefer this one or that one.
Okay. I know my last question is going to be a no. At least I think so, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you have any pets?
I don't have pets.
No.
I used to have pets as a child and I loved them, but my traveling schedule makes it difficult to have a pet.
That's what I figured. But I thought
I'd ask
anyway.
Although there could be a dog or a cat in the future.
Aha. That would be fun. That would be nice. Well, this
it
is.
Would be.
Yeah. No, well, I have two dogs. You know, I just can't imagine my life without my girls. So they.
I'm envying you. Yeah. What kind are they?
Oh, they're called Eurasiers. And they're a European breed that we fell in love with. They are useless. They were bred for nothing except companionship. And they are fabulous companions. They're funny and they're beautiful and they're way too furry. They have way too much fur.
That sounds wonderful.
They are
wonderful.
I need
to research that.
I love it. Well, Jan, this, as always, has been just a wonderful conversation. I thank you so much. Are you planning to be at NABS in March in Sacramento, maybe?
Not sure yet. Again, there's so many things going on, and trying to fit it all in can be difficult.
Okay.
But it would be lovely to go. I haven't been to NAB in a few years, and it's always fun to meet the builders, and there are so many amazing bikes out there. So.
Well, I will be at that one. So hopefully, if you're there, we can meet
hopefully
up.
Hopefully we'll meet.
And that would be fun. Thanks so much for talking with me. I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thanks. You too.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jan Hein. If you're interested, you can read and study his blog, Off the Beaten Path. And from there, you'll find links to the magazine, Bicycle Quarterly, and to the Compass Cycle Store. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to speak with the New England Builder Ball's Eric Weiss. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back, and it's off to Boston we go to learn more about this year's New England Builders Ball with the director, Eric Weiss. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. It looks like it's New England Builders Ball time again.
Hi, Diane. It sure is every fall. And as the days start to grow shorter, that means the ball is on its way.
It is indeed. Eighth annual edition at the Innovation and Design Building in Boston. We were there last year. It's a great venue. So Saturday, September 22nd. Tell us a little bit about the history of the Builders Ball, and then let's talk about this year's show.
Sure. Well, the origin story for this show is me complaining to a friend about how the North American Handmade Bike Show never made it to New England, and this is 8 years ago. And my friend turning to me and saying, quit whining and just do something. So I said, okay, that's actually a good idea. So I made our own show for New England. And that was how the Builders Ball started with the first show in 2011.
Wow, it doesn't seem possible that it's already been that many years, but it has indeed. What is it that the Builders Ball brings to the New England area and anybody on the East Coast, actually?
Well, I think the fun thing, well, one of the fun things about the Builder's Ball as compared to other shows is that while technically it's a consumer expo, I've designed the show to be sort of the anti-expo. So think of all the things that you dislike about a traditional consumer expo and just cross those things off the list. So there's no giant expo hall, and there's no hum of HVAC, and there's no getting charged $12 for a plastic cup of beer, and there's no having to hike across 10 acres of a parking lot to get there. It's always in a distinctive space, a space which makes you feel welcome. It's a comfortable place to be in, and with great music and just a really fun, creative, friendly atmosphere, one that is welcoming to attendees, but notably is actually an environment that exhibitors actually enjoy being in.
It was interesting last year walking around the show. Everybody was so friendly. The exhibitors were so friendly. I mean, the attendees had fun, but I'm not sure that the exhibitors didn't have more fun.
It's notable that a lot of the frame builders are one-person shops, and they're kind of isolated on a day-to-day. And so coming out to a show like the New England Builders Ball is, for many of these guys, the one time of year that they're going to see some of their friends.
Right. So that's how the original NAB show was. It was a little tiny group of like 12 people down in Texas, and they were all buddies, but they never got to see each other. So this is that same kind of thing. Tell us a few of the exhibitors who are returning this year and then some of the newer ones.
Happy to. Some of the frame builders that come back year after year are 44 Bikes out of New Hampshire. That's Chris Henry, and he has an extraordinary range of bikes for off-road, but also on-road use. There is, of course, Firefly Bicycles out of Boston. Those three guys have been making the most amazing bikes for road and cyclocross and gravel riding and mountain for years, and in titanium and steel. And they're especially known for their finish work as well. Then we've got one of the attendee favorites every year is Chapman Cycle. It's Brian Chapman out of Rhode Island, and he carries on the tradition of the constructeur style of building, similar to Peter Weigel. We also have Doug Breismeister, who builds out of New York City. He was the winner of the best gravel bike at NABS earlier this year, and he'll be doing the show again. I think this is his fourth time. And Brian Hollingsworth from Royal H Cycles, who has a strong following. And we've also got some younger builders. There's a fellow named Max Pratt out of Providence, Rhode Island, and he's a recent graduate of the Rhode Island School of Design. And he has a really good eye for design. I'm excited to see what he puts together. There's Galaxy Gearworks out of Vermont. We have our first Canadian exhibitor this year. That's Fluent Frameworks from Nova Scotia. And then a whole bunch of others that your exhibitors have probably heard of, like Beardman Bicycles and Pioneer Valley Frameworks out of Western Mass. Lule Cycle, who's north of Boston. And then our sponsor, Velo Orange, will be bringing some bikes as well, along with all the components and accessories that they want to put on display. And in addition to all the frame builders, we also every year have accessory makers come and exhibit as well. Bag makers and people who are making electronics and artists. It's a very broad brush sort of show, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, but what's interesting is it doesn't overwhelm you when you walk in the room. When you go to these big convention halls and you just see booth after booth after booth after booth and you sort of get turned around and you're not sure where you are, you come to the Builder's Ball and it's very welcoming and kind of homey. I mean, you come in and and it doesn't feel overwhelming. There's plenty there, but it's not like it's oppressive. And those, there are big, beautiful windows that look out onto, I'm not sure what we see. What do we see out of those windows?
Well, what you saw last year, depending on which windows you were looking at, was either downtown Boston or Boston Harbor.
Oh, the harbor.
Across the harbor toward the airport. This year we're in a different room, and it's going to be looking out onto a historical part of what used to be called the South Boston Army Base, which is still a very industrial and interesting area. There's an actual functioning dry dock right across the street from the building. Be pretty fascinating. But what you say about it feeling welcoming, that's by design. So the idea, the reason behind a lot of decisions that I make about this show is I want people to walk in and not feel like they just walked onto the floor of Interbike on Consumer Day, which is a place not many people actually want to be. And instead, feel like you've walked into a gallery opening with a whole lot of your friends there. And everybody's ready to have a good time and enjoy the artwork.
You also have people who benefit from the show. You, of course, you and I are both involved in the East Coast Greenway. There's Mass Bike. As I remember...
Boston Cyclist Union.
That's right.
Beneficiary.
That's right. Boston Cyclist Union. And so all three benefit from the Builder's Ball, which I think is a really cool thing. You usually have beer, so people get to drink.
yes.
You know, except for the little kids. They're not allowed to drink. I'm sorry.
That's right.
And so tell us again where it is, when it is, and how to find out more about it, Eric.
Thank you. It's the New England Builder's Ball on Saturday, September 22nd from 2 to 10 p.m. The venue is called the Innovation and Design Building, and the physical address is 19 Dry Dock Avenue in Boston. People can learn more by going to the website, which is newenglandbuildersball.com, or find the show on Instagram. The handle is at Builder's Ball. Or just search New England Builders Ball on Facebook and you'll find us there too.
Well, I wish you lots of luck. We were just on the East Coast. We will not be able to come back this year, but we'll keep watching what's going on. And I will remind our listeners again right before the show that they can still get tickets to the Builders Ball. Thanks so much, Eric.
Well, thanks for having me back, Diane.
All right. You have a wonderful day and tick more of those items off that list.
You have to, don't I?
All righty. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. My thanks to Eric Weiss, show director for the New England Builders Ball. Once again, it is September 22nd from 2 to 10 p.m. at the Innovation and Design Building in Boston. If you are interested, log on to newenglandbuildersball.com. So thanks so much for listening. Please consider becoming a sponsor of The Outspoken Cyclist by logging on to the OutspokenCyclist.com blog and clicking the donate button. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe out there. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.